Oh, why you can't. Todd would join us, I say, in a second. Others aren't so sure about that, my girl. I open my mouth to reply, but she interrupts. If he's even still alive. Which matters not, because we can't afford to have you captured. You're the most valuable prize of all. The girl who can help the president when the ships land. She holds up her hand. I won't have this fight with you again. There is too much important work to do. The camp feels silent now. The people behind her have stopped moving as we stare at one another, no one willing to ask her to get out of the way. Not even Mistresses Forth and Nadari, who wait there patiently. Like Thea, they've barely spoken to me since my arrival, all these acolytes of Mistress Coyle, all these people who wouldn't dare to dream of speaking to her the way I'm speaking to her now. They treat me as if I'm a little dangerous. I'm slightly surprised to find I kind of like it. I look into her eyes, into the unyieldingness of them. I won't forgive you, I say quietly, as if I'm only talking to her. I won't. Not now, not ever. I don't want your forgiveness, she says, equally quietly. But one day you will understand. And then her eyes glint, and she pulls her mouth into a smile. You know, she says, raising her voice, I think it's time you had some employment.
22:10:17. Can't you effing things move any faster? The four or five spackle nearest to me flinch away, though I ain't even spoken that loud. Get a move on! And as ever, no thoughts, no noise, no nothing. They can only be getting the cure and the fodder I still have to shovel out. But why? Why when no one else is? It makes them a sea of silent clicking, and white backs bent into the cold, and white mouths sending out puffs of steam, and white arms pulling up handfuls of dirt, and when you're looking out across the monastery grounds, all those white bodies working, well, they could be a herd of sheep, couldn't they? Even though if you look close, you can see family groups, and husbands, and wives, and fathers, and sons. You can see older ones lifting smaller amounts more slowly. You can see younger ones helping them, trying to keep us from seeing that the older ones can't work too hard. You can see a baby strapped to its mother's chest with an old piece of cloth. You can see an especially tall one directing others along a faster work chain. You can see a small female packing mud around the infected number band of a larger female. You can see them working together, keeping their heads down, trying not to be the one who gets seen by me or Davy or the guards behind the barbed wire. You can see all that if you look close. But it's easier if you don't. We can't give them shovels, of course. They could use them against us as weapons, and the soldiers on the walls get twitchy if a spackle even stretches its arms up too high. So there they all are, bending to the ground, digging, moving rocks, silent as clouds, suffering, and not doing nothing about it. I got a weapon, though. They gave me the rifle back. 'Cause where am I gonna go, now that she's gone? Hurry it up! I shout at the spackle, my noise rising red at the thought of her. I catch Davy looking over at me, a surprised grin on his face. I turn away and cross the field to another group. I'm halfway there when I hear a louder click. I look round till I find the source. But it's only ever the same one. 10:17, staring at me again, with that look that ain't forgiveness. He moves his eyes to my hands. It's only then I realize I've got them both clenched hard around my rifle. I can't even remember taking it off my shoulder. Even with all this spackle labor, it's still going to take a couple of months to even come close to finishing this building, whatever it is, and by that time it'll be midwinter, and the spackle won't have the shelter they were supposed to be building for themselves, and I know they live outside more than men do, but I don't think even they can live unsheltered in the winter frost, and I ain't heard of nowhere else they're going to be going yet. Still, we had all the internal walls torn down in 7 days, 2 ahead of schedule. And no spackle even died, though we did have a few with broken arms. Those spackle were taken away by soldiers. We ain't seen 'em since. By the end of the second week after the tower bomb, we've nearly dug all the trenches and blocks for the foundations to be poured, something Davy and I are supposed to supervise, even though it's going to be the spackle who know how to do it. Pa says they were the labor that rebuilt the city after the spackle war, Davy says, though you wouldn't know it from this bunch. He spits out a shell from the seeds he's eating. Food's getting a bit scarce, what with the answer adding supply raids to the ongoing bombs, but Davy always manages to scrounge up something. We're sitting on a pile of rocks, looking out over the one big field, now dug up with square holes and ditches, and so full of rock piles there's barely any room for the spackle to crowd into. But they do, cramming into the edges and huddling together in the cold, and they don't say nothing about it. Davy spits out another shell. You ever gonna talk again? I talk, I say. No, you scream at your workforce and you grunt at me. That ain't talking. He spits out another shell, high and long, hitting the nearest spackle in the head. It just brushes it away and keeps on digging out the last of a trench. She left you, Davy says. Get over it. My noise rises. Shut up! I don't mean it in a bad way. I turn to look at him, eyes wide. What? He says. I'm just saying, you know. She left. Don't mean she's dead or nothing. Spit. From what I remember, that filly can take plenty care of herself. There's a memory in his noise of being electrocuted on the river road. It should make me smile, but it don't, 'cause she's standing right there in his noise, standing right there and taking him down. Standing right there and not standing right here. Where'd she go? Where'd she effing go? Mayor Ledger told me just after the tower bombs that the army had gone straight for the ocean, 'cause they'd got a tip-off that that's where the answer were hiding. Was it me? Did he hear it in me? I burn at the thought. But when Mr. Hammer and his men got there, they didn't find nothing but long-abandoned buildings and half-sunken boats, 'cause the information turned out to be false. And I burn at that, too. Did she lie to me? Did she do it on purpose? Jesus, pig piss! Davy spits again. It's not like any of the rest of us got girlfriends. They're all in ruddy jail or setting off bombs every week or walking around in groups so big you can't even talk to them. She ain't my girlfriend, I say. Not the point, he says. All it means is that you're just as alone as the rest of us, so get over it. There's a sudden ugly strength of feeling in his noise, which he wipes away in an instant when he sees me watching him. What are you looking at? Nothing, I say. Damn right, he stands, takes his rifle, and stomps back into the field. Somehow, 1017 keeps ending up in my part of the work. I'm mainly in the back part of the fields, finishing up digging the trenches. Davy's near the front, getting spackle to snap together the preformed guide walls we'll be using once the concrete gets poured. 1017's supposed to be doing that, but every time I look up, there he is, nearest me again, no matter how many times I send him back. He's working, sure, digging up handfuls of dirt or piling up the sod in even rows, but always looking for me, always trying to catch my eye, clicking at me. I walk toward him, my hand up on the stock of my rifle, gray clouds starting to move in overhead. I sent you over to Davy, I bark. What are you doing here? Davy, hearing his name, calls from far across the field. What? I call back. Why do you keep letting this one back over here? What the hell are you talking about? Davy yells. They all look the same. It's 1017. Davy gives an exaggerated shrug. So? I hear a click, a rude and sarcastic one from behind me. I turn and I swear 1017 is smiling at me. You little piece of... I start to say, reaching my rifle around my front, which is when I see a flash of noise, coming from 1017, quick as anything, but clear, too, me standing in front of him, reaching for my rifle, nothing more than what he's seeing with his eyes, except a flash as he grabs the rifle from me, and then it's gone. I've still got the rifle in my hands, 10-17 still knee-deep in the ditch, no noise at all. I look him up and down. He's skinnier than he used to be, but they all are. They never get quite enough fodder for a day, and I'm wondering if 10-17's been skipping meals altogether, so he don't take no cure. "What are you playing at?" I ask him. But he's back at work, arms and hands digging for more dirt, ribs showing through the side of his white, white skin. And he don't say nothing. "Why do we keep giving him the cure if your pa's taking it away from everyone else?" Me and Davy are lunching the next day. The clouds are heavy in the sky, and it'll probably start raining soon. The first rain in a good long while. And it'll be cold rain, too. But we've got orders to keep working, no matter what, so we're spending the day watching the spackle pour out the first concrete from the mixer. Ivan brought it in this morning, healed but limping, his noise raging. I wonder where he thinks the power is now. "Well, it keeps them from plotting, don't it?" Davy says. "Keeps them from passing along ideas to each other." "But they can do that with the clicking," I think for a second. "Can't they?" Davy just gives a "who cares, pig piss" shrug. "Got any of that sandwich left?" I hand him my sandwich, keeping an eye out over the spackle. "Shouldn't we know what they're thinking?" I say. "Wouldn't that be a good thing to know?" I look out over the field for 10-17, who, sure enough, is looking back at me. Plick. The first drop of rain hits me on the eyelash. "Ah, crap," Davy says, looking up. It don't let up for 3 days. The site gets muckier and muckier, but the mayor still wants us to keep on somehow, so those 3 days are spent slipping and sliding through mud and putting up huge tarpaulins on frames to cover big parts of the field. Davy's got the inside work, bossing spackle around to keep the tarpaulin frames in place. I spend most of my time out in the rain, trying to keep the edges of the tarpaulin pinned to the ground with heavy stones. It's ruddy, stupid work. "Hurry up!" I shout to the spackle, helping me get one of the last edges pinned to the ground. My fingers are freezing, 'cause no one's given us gloves, and there ain't been no mayor around to ask. "Ow!" I put a bloodied knuckle up to my lips, having scraped my hand for the millionth time. The spackle keep at it with the rocks, seeming oblivious to the rain, which is good, 'cause there ain't room under the tarpaulins for all of them to shelter. "Hey!" I say, raising my voice. "Watch the edge! Watch that!" A gust of wind rips away the whole sheet of tarpaulin we just pinned down. One of the spackle keeps hold of it as it flies up, taking him with it and tumbling him hard down to the ground. I leap over him as I chase after the tarpaulin, twisting and rolling away across the muddy field and up a little slope, and I've just about got a hand on it, and I slip badly, skidding right down the other side of the slope on my rump. And I realize where I've run, where I've slipped. I'm heading right down into the bog. I grab at the mud to stop myself, but there's nothing to hold on to, and I drop right in with a splat. "Gah!" I shout and try to stand. I'm up to my thighs in lime-covered spackle shit, splattered all up my front and back, the stink of it making me retch. And I see another flash of noise, of me standing in the bog, of a spackle standing right over me. I look up. There's a wall of spackle staring. And right in front of them all, 10-17, above me, with a huge stone in his hands. He don't say nothing. Just stands there with the stone, more and big enough to do a lot of harm if thrown right. "Yeah?" I say up to him. "That's what you want, ain't it?" He just stares back. I don't see the noise again. I reach up for my rifle, slowly. "What's it gonna be?" I ask, and he can see in my noise just how ready I am. How ready I am to fight him. How ready I am to... I've got the rifle stock in my hand now. But he's just staring at me. and then he tosses the rock down on the ground and turns back toward the tarpaulin. I watch him go. 5 steps, then 10, and my body relaxes a bit. It's when I'm pulling myself out of the bog that I hear it. The click. His rude click. And I lose it. I'm running toward him, and I'm yelling, but I don't know what I'm saying, and Davy's turning around in shock as I reach the shelter of the tarpaulin just after 10:17, and I'm running in with the rifle up above my head like I'm some stupid madman, and 10:17's turning to me, but I don't give him a chance to do nothing, and I knock him hard in the face with the butt of the rifle, and he falls back on the ground, and I lift the rifle again, and I bring it down, and he raises his hands to protect himself, and I hit him again, and again, and again, in the hands, and the face, and in those skinny ribs, and my noise is raging, and I hit, and I hit, and I hit, and I'm screaming out, "Why did you leave? Why did you leave me?" And I hear the cold, crisp snick of his arm breaking. It fills the air, louder than the rain or the wind, turning my stomach upside down, making a thick lump in my throat. I stop mid-swing. Davy's staring at me, his mouth open. All the spackle are edging back, terrified. And from the ground, 10:17 is looking back up at me, red blood pouring from his weird nose and the corner of his two high eyes. But there's no sound coming from him. No noise, no thoughts, no clicks, no nothing. And we're in the campsite, and there's a dead spackle on the ground, and Viola's looking so scared, and she's backing away from me, and there's blood everywhere, and I've done it again. I've done it again. And why did you go, oh, Jesus, damn it, Viola, why did you leave? And 10:17 just looks at me, and I swear to God, it's a look of triumph.
23. Something's coming.
Water pump's working again, Hildy.
Thank you, Wilf. I hand him a tray of bread, the heat still coming off it. Could you take these to Jane, please? She's setting the tables for breakfast. He takes the tray, a flat little tune coming from his noise. As he leaves the kitchen shack, I hear him call out,
"Wife!"
Why does he call you Hildy?
Lee says, appearing at the back door with a basket of flour he just pounded. He's wearing a sleeveless shirt, and the skin up to his elbows is dusty white. I look at his bare arms for a second, and look away quickly. Mistress Coyle put us to work together, since he can't go back to New Prentice Town anymore either. No, I will certainly not forgive her. Hildy was the name of someone who helped us, I say. Someone worth being called after.
And by us, you mean?
Me and Todd, yes. I take the basket of flour from him and thump it down heavily on the table. There's a silence, as there always seems to be when Todd's name comes up.
No one's seen him, Viola,
Lee says gently.
But they mostly go in at night, so that doesn't...
She wouldn't tell me even if she did. I start separating the flour into bowls. She thinks he's dead. Lee shifts from foot to foot.
But you say different.
I look at him. He smiles, and I can't help but smile back.
And you believe me, do you?
He shrugs.
Wilf believes you. And you'd be surprised how far the word of Wilf goes around here.
No. I look out the window to where Wilf disappeared. No, actually, I wouldn't. That day passes like the others, and still we cook. That's our new employment, Lee and me, cooking. All of it, for the entire camp. We've learned how to make bread from a starting point of wheat, not even flour. We've learned how to skin squirrels, deshell turtles, and gut fish. We've learned how much base you need for soup to feed 100. We've learned how to peel potatoes and pears faster than possibly anyone on this whole stupid planet. Mistress Coyle swears this is how wars are won.
This isn't really why I signed up,
Lee says, pulling another handful of feathers off the 16th forest fowl of the afternoon. At least signing up was your idea, I say, fingers cramping on my own fowl. The feathers hover in the air like a swarm of sticky flies, catching everywhere they touch. I've got little green puffs under my fingernails,
in the crooks of my elbows, glopped in the corner of my eyes. I know this because Lee's got them all over his face, too, all through his long golden hair and in the matching golden hair on his forearms. I feel my face flush again and pull out a furious rip of feathers. A day turned into two, turned into three, turned into a week, turned into the week after and the week after that, cooking with Lee, washing up with Lee, sitting out 3 days of solid rain stuck in this shack with Lee. And still, something's coming. Something's being prepared for, no one's telling me anything. And I'm still stuck here. Lee tosses a plucked fowl onto the table and picks up another one.
We're going to make this species extinct if we're not careful.
It's the only thing Magnus can shoot, I say. Everything else is too fast.
A whole animal lost, Lee says, because the answer lacked an optician.
I laugh, too loud. I roll my eyes at myself. I finish my own fowl and pick up a new one. I'm doing 3 of these for every 2 of yours, I say. And I did more loaves this morning, and...
You burned half of them.
Because you stoked the oven too hot.
I'm not made for cooking,
he says, smiling.
I'm made for soldiering.
I gasp. And you think I'm made for cooking? But he's laughing and keeps laughing, even when I throw a handful of wet feathers at him, smacking him straight on the eye. Ow! He says, wiping it away.
You got some aim, Viola. We really need to get a gun in your hands.
I turn my face quickly back down to the millionth fowl in my lap.
Or maybe not,
he says, more quietly. Have you... I stop.
Have I what?
I lick my lips, which is a mistake, because then I have to spit out a mouthful of feathery puffs. So when I do finally say it, it comes out more exasperated than I meant. Have you ever shot someone?
No.
He sits up straighter.
Have you?
I shake my head and see him relax, which makes me immediately say, but I've been shot. He sits back up.
No way.
I say it before I mean to, before I even know it's coming. And then I'm saying it, and I realize I've never said it. Not out loud, not to myself. Not ever, not since it happened, and yet here it is, tumbling out in a room full of floating feathers. And I've stabbed someone. I stop plucking. To death. My body feels suddenly twice as heavy in the silence that follows. When I start to cry, Lee just hands me a kitchen towel and lets me. Not crowding me or saying anything stupid or even asking about it, that we must be dying of curiosity. He just lets me cry. Which is exactly right.
Yes, but we're gaining sympathy,
Lee says near the end of dinner with Wilf and Jane. I'm putting off finishing because as soon as I do, we have to go back to the kitchens to start preparing the yeasts to cook tomorrow's bread. You wouldn't believe how much bloody bread 100 people can eat. I take half of my last bite. I'm just saying, there aren't very many of you.
Of us,
Lee says, looking at me seriously.
And we've got spies working throughout the city, and people join us when they can. Things are only getting worse there. They're rationing food now, and no one's getting the cure anymore. They're going to have to start turning against him.
And so many in prisons, Jane adds. Hundreds of women all locked up, all chained together underground, starving and dying by the dozen.
Wife,
Wilf snaps.
I'm only saying what I heard.
You didn't hear nothing of the sort.
Jane looks sullen.
Don't mean it's not true.
There are a lot of people who'd support us in prison, though,
Lee says.
And so that might turn out.
He stops. What? I ask, looking up. Turn out what? He doesn't answer me, just looks over to another table where Mistress Coyle is sitting with Mistresses Braithwaite, Forth, Wagner, Barker,
and Thea, too, like they always do, discussing things, whispering in low voices, devising secret orders for other people to carry out.
Nothing,
Lee says, seeing Mistress Coyle stand and come toward us. I'm going to need the cart hitched up for tonight, Wilf, please, she says, approaching our table.
Yes, mistress,
he says, getting to his feet. Eat a little longer, she says, stopping him. This isn't forced labor.
I'm happy to do it,
Wilf says, brushing off his trousers and leaving us. Who are you blowing up tonight? I ask. Mistress Coyle pulls her lips tight.
I think that's enough for now, Viola.
I want to come, I say. If you're going back into the city tonight, I want to come with you.
Patience, my girl, she says. You'll have your day.
Which day? I ask as she walks off. When?
Patience, she says again.
But she says it impatiently. It gets dark earlier and earlier every day. I sit outside on a pile of rocks as night falls, watching tonight's mission takers head out to the carts, their bags packed with secret things. Some of the men have noise now, taking reduced amounts of cure from our own dwindling supply stashed in the cave. They take enough to blend in with the city, but not enough to give anything away. It's a tricky balance, and it's getting more and more dangerous for our men to be on city streets, but still they go. And as the people of New Prentice Town sleep tonight, they'll be stolen from and bombed, all in the name of what's right.
Hey,
Lee says, hardly more than a shadow in the twilight as he sits down next to me. Hey, I say back.
You okay?
Why wouldn't I be?
Yeah.
He picks up a stone and tosses it into the night.
Why wouldn't you be?
Stars start to appear in the sky. My ships are up there somewhere. People who might have been able to help us. No, who would have helped us if I could have contacted them. Simone Watkin and Bradley Tench. Good people. Smart people who would have stopped all the stupidity and the explosions and... I feel my throat clench again.
You really killed someone,
Lee says, tossing another stone. Yeah, I say, pulling my knees up to my chest. Lee waits a moment.
With Todd?
For Todd, I say. To save him. To save us. Now that the sun's gone, the real cold moves in swiftly. I hold my knees tighter.
She's afraid of you, you know,
he says.
Mistress Coyle. She thinks you're powerful.
I look over at him, trying to see him in the dark.
That's stupid. I heard her say it to Mistress Braithwaite. Said you could lead whole armies if you put your mind to it.
I shake my head, but of course he can't see. She doesn't even know me.
Yeah, but she's smart.
And everyone here follows her like little lambs.
Everyone but you.
He bumps me with his shoulder in a friendly way.
Maybe that's what she's talking about.
We start to hear the low rumble from the caves that means the bats are readying themselves. Why are you here? I ask. Why do you follow her? I've asked before, but he's always changed the subject. But maybe tonight's different. It sure feels different.
My father died in the Spackle War,
he says. Lots of fathers did, I say. And I think of Corinne, wondering where she is, wondering if...
I don't really remember him,
Lee's saying.
It was just me and my mother and my older sister growing up, really. And my sister.
He laughs.
You'd like her. All mouth and fire, and we had some fights you wouldn't believe.
He laughs again, but more quietly.
When the army came, Siobhan wanted to fight, but Mum didn't. I wanted to fight too, but Siobhan and Mum really went at it. Siobhan ready to take up arms, and Mum practically having to bar the door to keep her from running out into the streets when the army came marching in. The rumbling is getting louder, and the bat's noise starts to echo through the cave opening.
Fly, fly,
they say.
Away, away.
And then it was out of our hands, wasn't it?
He says.
The army was here, and that night they took all the women away to the houses east of town. Mom said to cooperate, you know, just for now, just to see where it goes. Maybe he's not all that bad. That sort of thing. I don't respond, and I'm glad it's dark, so he can't see my face.
But Siobhan wasn't going without a fight, was she? She shouted and screamed at the soldiers and refused to go along. Mom's just begging her to stop, to not make them angry, but Siobhan...
He stops and makes a clicking sound with his tongue.
Siobhan punched the first soldier who tried to move her by force.
He takes a deep breath.
And then it was uproar. I tried to fight, and the next thing I know, I'm on the ground with my ears ringing and a soldier's knee in my back. And Mom is screaming, but there's nothing from Siobhan, and I black out, and when I wake up, I'm alone in my house.
Fly, fly,
we hear, just inside the cave mouth.
Away, away, away.
I looked for them when the restrictions eased,
he says,
but I never found them. I looked in every cabin and dormitory and at every house of healing. And finally, at the last one, Mistress Coyle answered.
He pauses and looks up.
Here they come.
The bats swarm out of the caves, like the world's been tipped on its side and they're being poured out over the top of us, a flood of greater darkness against the night sky. The sheer whoosh of them makes it impossible to talk for a minute, so we just sit and watch them. Each is at least 6 feet across, with furred wings and short stubby ears and a green glowing dot of phosphorus on each outstretched wingtip, which they use somehow to confuse and stun the moths and bugs they eat. The dots glow in the night, making a blanket of temporary fluttering stars above us. We sit, surrounded by the slapping of wings, the cheeping of their noise, the
fly, fly, away, away, away.
And in 5 minutes they're gone, out into the surrounding forest, not to return until just before dawn.
Something's coming,
Lee says in the quiet that follows.
You know that. I can't say what, but I'm going along because there's one more place to look for them.
Then I'll go too, I say.
She won't let you.
He turns to me.
But I promise you I'll look for Todd. With the same eyes I'd look for Siobhan and my mother, I'll look for him.
A bell chimes out over the camp, signaling all raiding teams are off into town and all remaining people in camp are to go to bed. Lee and I sit in the dark for a while longer, his shoulder brushed up against mine, and mine brushed up against his.
24. Prison Walls. Not bad, says the mayor from atop Morpeth, for an unskilled workforce. There'd be more, Davy says, but it rained, and then everything was just mud. No, no, the mayor says, casting his eyes around the field. You've done admirably, both of you, managing so much in just a month. We all take a minute to look at what we've managed admirably. We've gotten all the concrete foundations poured for a single long building. Every guide wall is up. Some have even started to be filled in by the stones we took from the monastery's internal walls, and the tarpaulin makes a kind of roof. It already looks like a building. He's right. We have done admirably, us and 1,150 spackle. Yes, says the mayor, very pleasing. Davy's noise is taking on a pinkish glow that's uncomfortable to look at. So what is it? I ask. The mayor looks my way. What's what? This, I gesture at the building. What's it supposed to be? You finish building it, Todd. And I promise to invite you to the grand opening. It's not for the spackle, though, is it? The mayor frowns slightly. No, Todd, it's not. I rub the back of my neck with my hand, and I can hear some clanking in Davy's noise. Clanks that are gonna get louder if he thinks I'm messing up his moment of praise. It's just, I say, there's been frost the past 3 nights, and it's only getting colder. The mayor turns Morpeth to face me.
Boycolt,
he thinks.
Boycolt steps back.
I step back without even thinking. The mayor's eyebrows raise. Are you wanting heaters for your workforce?
Well,
I look at the ground, and at the building, and at the spackle, who are doing their best to stay at the far end, as much away from the three of us as is possible to do when there are so many crowded into such a limited space.
Snow might come, I say. I don't know that they'll survive.
Oh, they're tougher than you think, Todd. The mayor's voice is low and full of something I can't put my finger on. A lot tougher. I look down again.
Yeah, I say. Okay.
I'll have Private Pharaoh bring in some small fission heaters, if that will make you feel better.
I blink.
Really?
Really?
Davy says. They've done good work, the mayor says, under your direction, and you've shown real dedication these past weeks, Todd. Real leadership. He smiles, almost warmly. I know you're the kind of soul who hates to see others suffer. He keeps hold of my eye, almost daring me to break it. Your tenderness does you credit.
Tenderness?
Davy snickers. I'm proud of you. The mayor gathers up his reins. Both of you. And you will be rewarded for your efforts. Davy's noise beams again as the mayor rides out of the monastery gates.
Did you hear that? He says, waggling his eyebrows. Rewards, my tender pig piss.
Shut up, Davy. I'm already walking down the guide wall and toward the back of the building where there's the last of the clear ground, and so that's where all the spackle are having to crowd themselves. They get out of my way as I move through them.
Heaters are coming, I say, putting it in my noise, too. Things will be better.
But they just keep doing all they can not to touch me.
I said, things will be better.
Stupid, ungrateful. I stop. I take in a breath. I keep walking. I get to the back of the building where we've leaned a few unused guide walls against the building frame, forming a nook. You can come out now, I say. There's no sound for a minute. Then a bit of rustling as 1017 emerges, his arm in a sling made up from one of my few shirts. He's skinnier than ever, some redness still creeping up his arm from the break, but it seems to be finally fading. I manage to scrounge some painkillers, I say, taking him out of my pocket. He snatches him from my hand with a slap, scratching my palm.
Watch it,
I say through clenched teeth. You want to be taken away to whatever they do with lame spackle? There's a burst of noise from him, one I've grown to expect, and it's the usual thing. Him standing over me with a rifle, him hitting me and hitting me, me pleading for him to stop, him breaking my arm.
Yeah, I say, whatever.
Playing with your pet?
Davy's come round too, leaning against the building with his arms crossed. You know, when horses break their legs, they shoot him. He ain't a horse.
Nah, Davy says, he's a sheep.
I puff out my lips. Thanks for not telling your pa. Davy shrugs.
Whatever, pig piss, as long as it don't screw up our reward.
1017 makes his rude clicking at both of us, but mostly at me.
He don't seem too grateful, though, Davy says.
Yeah, well, I saved him twice now. I look at 1017, look right into eyes that never leave mine. I ain't doing it again.
You say that, Davy says, but everyone knows you will.
He nods at 1017.
Even him.
Davy's eyes widen in a mock.
It's 'cause you're tender.
Shut up. But he's already laughing and leaving, and 1017 just stares at me and stares at me. And I stare back. I saved him. I saved him for her. If she was here, she could see. See how I saved him. If she was here. But she ain't. I clench my fists, and then I force myself to unclench them. New Prentistown has changed in the past month. I see it every day as we ride home. Part of it's winter coming. The leaves on the trees have turned purple and red and dropped to the ground, leaving the tall winter skeletons behind them. The evergreens have kept their needles but dropped their cones, and the reachers have pulled their branches tight into their trunks, leaving naked poles to sit out the cold. All of it, plus the constant darker skies, make it look like the town's going hungry. Which it is. The army invaded at the end of harvest, so there were food stocks. But there's no one left in the outer settlements to bring in food to trade, and the answer are keeping up their bombs and food raids. One night, a whole storehouse of wheat was taken. So completely and successfully, it's obvious now there's people in the town and the army who've been helping them. Which is bad news for the town and the army. The curfew got lowered 2 weeks ago, and again last week, till no one's allowed out after dark at all, except for a few patrols. The square in front of the cathedral has become a place for bonfires, of books, of the worldly belongings of people found to have helped the answer, of a bunch of healer uniforms from when the mayor closed the last house of healing, and practically no one takes the cure no more, except some of the mayor's closest men, Mr. Morgan, Mr. O'Hare, Mr. Tate, Mr. Hammer, men from old Prentistown who have been with him for years. Loyalty, I guess. Me and Davy ain't never been given it in the first place, so there weren't never a chance for him to take it away. Maybe that's our reward, Davy says as we ride. Maybe he'll get some out of the cellar, and we'll finally see what it's like. Our reward, I think. We. I run my hand along Ang Harad's flank, feeling the chill in her skin. Almost home, girl, I whisper twixt her ears. Nice, warm barn. Warm, she thinks, boy colt. Ang Harad, I say back. Horses ain't pets, and they're half crazy all the time, but I've been learning if you treat them right, they get to know you. Boy colt, she thinks again, and it's like I'm part of her herd. Maybe the reward is women, Davy says suddenly. Yeah, maybe he's going to give us some women and finally make a real man out of you. Shut up, I say, but it don't turn into a fight. Come to think of it, we ain't had a fight in a good long while. We're just used to each other, I guess. We don't hardly see women no more, neither. When the communications tower fell, they were all confined to their houses again, except when teams of them are working the fields, readying for next year's planting, under guard from armed soldiers. The visits from husbands and sons and fathers are now once a week at most. We hear stories about soldiers and women, stories about soldiers getting into dormitories at night, stories about awful things going on that no one gets punished for. And that don't even count the women in the prisons, prisons I've only seen from the cathedral tower, a group of converted buildings in the far west of town down near the foot of the waterfalls. Who knows what goes on inside? They're way far away, out of sight of everyone except those that guard them. Kinda like the spackle. Jesus, Todd, Davy says, the racket you make by thinking all the time. Which is exactly the kind of thing I've learned to ignore from Davy, except this time, he called me Todd. We leave our horses in the barn near the cathedral. Davy walks me back to the cathedral, though I don't really need a guard no more. 'Cause where would I go? I go in the front door and I hear, Todd? The mayor's waiting for me. Yes, sir, I say. Always so polite, he smiles, walking toward me, boots clicking on the marble. You seem better lately, calmer. He stops a yard away. Have you been using the tool? Huh? What tool? I ask. He sighs a little, and then,
I am the circle, and the circle is me.
I put a hand up to the side of my head. How do you do that? Noise can be used, Todd,
he says, if you're disciplined enough. And the first step is using the tool.
I am the circle, and the circle is me?
It's a way of centering yourself, he nods. A way of aligning your noise, of reining it in, controlling it. And a man who can control his noise is a man with an advantage. I remember him chanting away back in his house in Old Prentice Town, how sharp and scary his noise sounded compared to the other men's, how much it felt like a weapon. What's the circle? I ask.
Your destiny, Todd Hewitt.
A circle is a closed system. There's no way of getting out, so it's easier if you don't fight it.
I am the circle, and the circle is me.
But this time, my voice is in there, too. There is so much I look forward to teaching you, he says, and leaves without saying goodnight. I pace the walls of the bell tower, looking out toward the falls in the west, the hill with the notch on it in the south, and to the east, the hills that lead toward the monastery, though you can't see it from here. All you can see is New Prentice Town, indoors and huddled together as a cold night settles in. She's out there somewhere. A month, and she ain't come. A month, and shut up. Just effin' shut up your effin' whiny mouth. I start pacing again. We've got glass in the openings now, and a heater to protect us from the autumn nights. More blankets, too, and a light, and approved books for Mayor Ledger to read.
Still a prison, though, isn't it?
He says behind me, mouth full.
You'd think he'd have at least found a better place for you by now.
I sure wish everyone would stop thinking it's okay to read me all the damn time, I say without turning around.
He probably wants you out of the town, he says, finishing up his meal, which is just over half what we used to get. Wants you away from all the rumors.
What rumors? I say, though I'm barely interested.
Oh, rumors of the great mind-control powers of our mayor, rumors of weapons made from noise, rumors he can fly, I don't doubt.
I don't look back at him, and I keep my noise quiet.
I am the circle, I think,
and then I stop. It's after midnight when the first one goes off.
Boom.
I jump a little on my mattress, but that's all.
Where do you think that was?
Mayor Ledger asks, also not rising from his bed.
Sounded near east, I say, looking up into the dark of the tower bells. Maybe a food store?
We wait for the second. There's always a second now. As the soldiers rush to the first, the answer take the chance for a second.
Boom.
There it is,
Mayor Ledger says, sitting up in bed and looking out of an opening. I get up, too.
Damn,
he says.
What?
I say, moving next to him.
I think that was the water plant down by the river.
What does that mean?
It means we'll have to boil every stupid cup of boom. There's a huge flash that causes me and Mayor Ledger to flinch back from the window. The glass shakes in its frames. And every light in New Prentice Town goes off.
The power station, Mayor Ledger says, unbelieving. But that's guarded every hour of the day. How could they possibly get to that?
I don't know, I say, my stomach sinking. But there's gonna be hell to pay.
Mayor Ledger runs a tired hand over his face as we hear sirens and soldiers shouting down in the city below. He's shaking his head.
I don't know what they think they're
Boom, 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 boom!
5 huge explosions, one right after the other, shaking the tower so much that me and Mayor Ledger are thrown to the floor, and a bunch of our windows shatter, busting inward, covering us in shards and powdery glass. We see the sky light up, the sky to the west. A cloud of fire and smoke shooting so high above the prisons, it's like a giant's flinging it there. Mayor Ledger is breathing heavy beside me.
They've done it, he says, gasping. They've really done it.
They've really done it, I think.
They've started their war.
And I can't help it. I can't help but think it.
Is she coming for me?
25. the night it happens.
I need your help,
Mistress Lawson says, standing in the doorway of the kitchen. I hold up my hands, covered in flour. I'm kind of in the middle of...
Mistress Coyle specifically asked me to fetch you.
I frown. I don't like the word fetch. Then who's going to finish these loaves for tomorrow? Lee's out getting firewood.
Mistress Coyle said you had experience in medical supplies.
Mistress Lawson interrupts.
We've brought a lot more in, and the girl I have now is hopeless at sorting them out.
I sigh. It's better than cooking, at least. I follow her out into the dusk, into the mouth of a cave and through a series of passages until we get to the large cavern where we keep our most valuable supplies.
This might take a while, Mistress Lawson says.
We spend most of the evening and into the night counting just how many medicines, bandages, compresses, bed linens, ethers, tourniquets, diagnostic bands, blood pressure straps, stethoscopes, gowns, water purification tablets, splints, cotton swabs, clamps, Jeffers root pills, adhesives, and everything else we have, sorting them out into smaller piles and spreading them across the supply cavern right up to the lip of the main tunnel. I wipe cold sweat from my forehead. Shouldn't we be stacking these up already?
Not just yet, Mistress Lawson says.
She looks around at the neat piles of everything we've done. She rubs her hands together, a worried frown creasing her face.
I hope it's enough.
Enough for what? I follow her with my eyes as she goes from pile to pile. Enough for what, Mistress Lawson? She looks up at me, biting her lip.
How much of your healing do you remember?
I stare at her for a second, suspicions rising and rising. Then I take off running out of the cavern.
Wait!
She calls after me, but I'm already out into the central tunnel, running out of the main mouth of the cave and shooting into the camp, which is deserted.
Don't be angry,
Mistress Lawson says after I've searched every cabin. I stand there stupidly, hands on my hips, staring around at the empty camp. Having found a distraction for me, Mistress Coyle left, along with all the other mistresses except for Mistress Lawson. Thea and the apprentices are gone, too. And everyone else. Every cart, horse, and ox. And Lee. Wilf's gone, too, though Jane is here, the only other one who stayed behind. Tonight's the night. Tonight's the night it happens.
You know why she couldn't take you,
Mistress Lawson says. She doesn't trust me, I say. None of you do.
That's neither here nor there right now,
she says, her voice taking on that stern mistress tone I've grown to hate.
What matters is that when they come back, we're going to need all the healing hands we can get.
I'm about to argue, but I see how much she's still wringing her hands, how worried her face looks, how much is going on beneath the surface. And then she says, if any of them make it back at all. There's nothing left to do but wait. Jane makes us coffee, and we sit in the increasing cold, watching the path out of the woods, watching to see who returns down it.
Frost,
Jane says, digging her toe across the small breath of ice frozen on a stone near her foot.
We should have done it earlier,
Mistress Lawson says into her cup, face over the rising steam.
We should have done it before the weather turned.
Done what? I ask.
Rescue,
Jane says simply.
Wilf told me when he was leaving.
Rescue of who? I say. Though of course it can only be... We hear rocks fall on the path. We're already on our feet when Magnus comes barreling over the hill.
Hurry!
He's shouting.
Come on!
Mistress Lawson grabs some of the most urgent of the medical supplies and starts running after him up the path. Jane and I do the same. We're halfway up when they start to come out of the forest. On the backs of carts, across the shoulders of others, on stretchers, on horseback, with more people pouring down the path behind them and more cresting the hill behind them. All the ones who needed rescuing. The prisoners locked away by the mayor and his army. And the state of them.
Oh, my God,
Jane says quietly next to me. Both of us stopped,
stunned. Oh my God. The next hours are a blur as we rush to bring the wounded into camp, though some of them are hurt so bad we have to treat them where they are. I'm ordered from one healer to another and another, racing from wound to wound, running back for more supplies, going so fast it's only after a while that I start to realize that most of the wounds being treated aren't from fighting. They've been beaten, I say. And starved, Mistress Lawson says angrily, setting up a fluid injection into the arm of a woman we've carried into the cave. And tortured. The woman is just one of a growing number that threatens never to stop. Most of them too shocked to speak, staring at you in the most horrible silence or keening at you without words. Burn scars on their arms and faces, old wounds left untreated, the sunken eyes of women who haven't eaten for days and days and days. He did this, I say to myself. He did this. Hold it together, my girl, Mistress Lawson says. We rush back outside, arms full of bandages that don't begin to cover what's needed. Mistress Braithwaite waves me over with a frantic hand. She tears the bandages from me, furiously wrapping up the leg of a woman screaming beneath her. Jeffers Root! Mistress Braithwaite snaps. I didn't bring any, I say.
Then bloody well get some.
I go back to the cave, twisting around healers and apprentices and fake soldiers crouched over patients everywhere, up the hillsides, on backs of carts, everywhere. It's not just women injured either. I see male prisoners, also starved, also beaten. I see people from the camp wounded in the fighting, including Wilf with a burn bandage up the side of his face, though he's still helping carry patients on stretchers into the camp. I run into the cave, grab more bandages and Jeffers Root, and run back to the gully for the dozenth time. I cross the open ground and look up the path, where a few more people are still arriving. I stop a second and check the new faces before running back to Mistress Braithwaite. Mistress Coyle hasn't returned yet. Neither has Lee. He was right in the thick of it, Mistress Nadari says, as I help her get a freshly drugged woman to her feet. Like he was looking for someone. His mother and sister, I say, taking the woman's weight against me. We didn't get everyone, Mistress Nadari says. There was a whole other building where the bomb didn't go off. Siobhan! We hear someone shout in the distance. I turn, my heart racing a lot faster and bigger than I expect, a smile breaking my cheeks. He's found them. But you can see right away it's not true. Siobhan! Lee is coming down the path from the forest, the arm and shoulder of his uniform blackened, his face covered in soot. His eyes looking everywhere, this way and that, through all the people in the gully as he walks through them. Mom? Go, Mistress Nadari says to me. See if he's hurt. I let the woman lean onto Mistress Nadari and I run toward Lee, ignoring the other mistresses calling my name. Lee! I call.
Viola?
He says, seeing me.
Are they here? Do you know if they're here?
Are you hurt? I reach him, taking the blackened sleeve and looking at his hands. You're burned.
There were fires,
he says, and I look into his eyes. He's looking at me, but he's not seeing me. He's seeing what he saw at the prisons. He's seeing the fires and what was behind them. He's seeing the prisoners they found. Maybe he's seeing guards he had to kill. He's not seeing his sister or his mother.
Are they here?
He pleads.
Tell me they're here.
I don't know what they look like, I say quietly. Lee stares at me, his mouth open, his breath heavy and raspy like he's breathed in a lot of smoke.
It was...
he says.
Oh God, Viola, it was...
He looks up and past me, over my shoulder.
I've got to find them. They've got to be here.
He steps past me and down the gully.
Siobhan? Mom?
I can't help it and I call after him. Lee, did you see Todd? But he keeps on walking, stumbling away.
Viola!
I hear, and at first I think it's just another mistress calling for my help. But then a voice beside me says, Mistress Coyle! I turn and look up. At the top of the path is Mistress Coyle, on horseback, clopping down the rocks of the path as fast as she can make the horse go. She's got someone in the saddle behind her,
Someone tied to her to keep them from falling off. I feel a jolt of hope. Maybe it's Siobhan. Or Lee's mom. Or him. Maybe it's him. Maybe...
Help us, Viola!
Mistress Coyle shouts, working the reins. And as I start to run up the hill toward them, the horse turns to find its footing and I see who it is, unconscious and leaning badly. Corinne. No, I keep saying under my breath, hardly realizing it. No. As we get her down onto a flat of rock and as Mistress Lawson runs toward us with armfuls of bandages and medicines. No. As I take her head in my hands to cradle it from the hard rock and Mistress Coyle tears off Corinne's sleeve to prepare for injections. No, as Mistress Lawson reaches us and gasps as she sees who it is. You found her, Mistress Lawson says. Mistress Coyle nods.
I found her.
I feel Corinne's skull under my hands, feel how the skin burns with fever. I see how sharp her cheeks look, how the bruising that discolors her eyes is against skin sagging and limp, and the collarbones that jut up from above the neckline of her torn and dirty mistress cloak, and the circles of burns against her neck, and the cuts on her forearms, and the tearing at her fingernails. Oh, Corinne, I whisper, and wet from my eyes drops onto her forehead. Oh, no.
Stay with us, my girl,
Mistress Coyle says, and I don't know whether she's talking to me or Corinne.
Sia?
Mistress Lawson asks, not looking up. Mistress Coyle shakes her head. Thea's dead? I ask.
And Mistress Wagner,
Mistress Coyle says, and I notice the smoke on her face, the red angry burns on her forehead.
And others.
Her mouth draws thin.
But we got some of them, too.
Come on, my girl,
Mistress Lawson says to Corinne, still unconscious.
You were always the stubborn one. We need that now.
Hold this,
Mistress Coyle says, handing me a bag of fluid connected to a tube injected into Corinne's arm. I take it in one hand, keeping Corinne's head in my lap.
Here it is,
Mistress Lawson says, peeling away a strap of crusted cloth on Corinne's side. A terrible smell hits all of us at the same time. It's worse than how sickening it stinks. It's worse because of what it means.
Gangrene,
Mistress Coyle says pointlessly, because we can all see that it's way past infection. The smell means the tissue's dead. It means it started to eat her alive. Something I wish I didn't remember that Corinne taught me herself.
They didn't even give her basic bloody treatment,
grunts Mistress Lawson, getting to her feet and running back toward the cave to get the heaviest medicines we've got.
Come on, my difficult girl,
Mistress Coyle says quietly, stroking Corinne's forehead.
You stayed until you found her, I say. That's why you were last.
She'd never yield, this one,
Mistress Coyle says, her voice rough and not just because of smoke.
No matter what they did to her.
We look down at Corinne's face, her eyes still closed, her mouth dropped open, her breath faltering. Mistress Coyle's right. Corinne would never yield, would never give names or information, would take the punishment to keep other daughters, other mothers, from feeling it themselves.
The infection, I say, my throat swelling. The smell, it means...
Mistress Coyle just bites her lips hard and shakes her head.
Oh, Corinne, I say.
Oh, no.
And right there in my hands, in my lap,